Spark of Faith, a talk by Father Chris Ryan, MGL, at the Australian Catholic Youth Ministry Convention in 2012.
The title of the talk, Advanced Youth Ministry Concepts, is not my title. It was given to me. I think Malcolm was particularly keen that people who've been involved in youth ministry for a while would have something that's aimed at them. Go for it. And so he asked if I'd do that. The problem, of course, with the topic like advanced youth ministry concepts is that could be just about anything. We could talk about a whole bunch of stuff. And I've just chosen to talk about really about one central kind of thing. So I'll get to that in a moment. The other great trauma of this workshop potentially is that I look around the room and I see people who I've known for many, many years, people who've been involved in youth ministry as long as I have in some instances. So one of the trauma in that for me is that I'll get really nervous. The exciting possibility in that, I hope, is that we actually engage in a conversation. I want to try and give you some ideas and to give you some substantial content, but I don't want it to be a monologue. So I'll try and leave enough time for a conversation at the end, but I'll also be looking for some conversation during the course of the workshop as well. That's the aim, okay? So without any more introductory comments, let's get into it. So to start with, first question, what are the goals of youth ministry? Karen, you're not allowed to answer it. No, what are the goals of youth ministry? To bring people to Christ. Anyone want to quote Anointed and Sent to me? So there are three goals in Anointed and Sent. Christian just spent some time in the session before last talking about number two, which is about the responsible participation of young people in the faith community, in the church. There are two other goals. To make disciples, right? Empowering young people to be disciples of Jesus in the world today. Okay, that's goal number three. What's goal number one?
Fostering personal and spiritual growth.
Terrific. Okay. So they're the three goals that Anointed and Sent talks about. Okay. One of the things about that, and I think Bishop Anthony kind of alluded to this in a way too, is they're very comprehensive kind of goals. That and the youth ministry framework that Anointed and Sent is based on is what's called a comprehensive youth ministry framework. And that's a very Catholic thing to do, to look at try and go for the whole. The word Catholic means according to the whole or universal. It's a very Catholic thing to say, let's get the whole big picture. Let's make sure we kind of cover all the bases. It's a deep Catholic kind of sensitivity that focuses on that. That's very valuable. And I think Bishop Anthony alluded to that today in his address, his keynote, when he was talking about the importance of making sure that we give young people the whole of the gospel, okay? And what he was saying there was the whole Catholic thing. We want them to really discover the fullness of what we believe and mean and live by as Catholics. Now, I agree with that completely, but the question I want to sort of look at today, in a sense, goes back behind that, which is why would young people want to have their personal and spiritual growth fostered? Why would they really want to be disciples of Jesus? And why would they really want to be active and responsible members of the church? And so the question that I want to try and open up together with you today is this one. Here's the question. What's the ignition point of faith for young people? Why would they want to be disciples of Jesus? Because I want to presume there that there's something that happens first before that. Why would they care about their total personal spiritual growth? And why would they want to be active members of the church? And I think this matters. I think the risk of only ever talking about the comprehensive thing is we don't really know where to start. We're not really sure what begins a young person's journey in faith. And so that's the question I want to try and open up with you this afternoon. What's the ignition point of faith for young people? What kicks it off? What starts it? Knowing that a whole bunch of things have to happen after that. And that's where Anointed and Sent is absolutely brilliant because it gives us a fantastic framework for what youth ministry should look like. But we've got to know where we're going to start. So that's the premise. Now, as Benita said in the introduction, I've been trying to work on my PhD in youth ministry for about the last 9 months. And one of the things that that has kind of, I suppose there are two quotes really that have been resonating with me and have stayed with me and kind of are annoying me. They're the kind of quotes that you kind of won't go away. And I wanted to share them with you as a way of beginning the response to this question. Both of them come from Benedict XVI. One from his first encyclical, which is the one I'm about to show you. And the second one actually comes from a book that he wrote many, many years ago in the 70s called Principles of Catholic Theology. But here's the first quote. So this is Benedict XVI, first encyclical, God is Love, Deus Caritas Est. And this is the very first paragraph. And I think that's really important. You see, when someone becomes a pope, their first encyclical really matters. They're wanting to say something really important, okay? When Benedict was elected, we had bets in the Missionaries of God's Love about what his first encyclical would be about. Betting in the Missionaries of God's Love doesn't count for much because of our vow of poverty, but you know, we threw around ideas, and I thought it was going to be about the church. The founder of the missionaries thought it was going to be about the Word of God. We were both wrong. It was about God being love. Here's the quote. Being Christian is not the result of an ethical choice or a lofty idea, but the encounter with an event, a person, which gives life a new horizon and a decisive direction. Being Christian is not the result of being good. That's an ethical choice. Okay? You don't become a Christian by saying, I'm going to try and be a better person. I'm going to try and be nicer, as Bishop Anthony was sort of alluding to today. Nor is it a lofty idea. Benedict's very strong on this. Christianity is not a philosophical system per se. It's not a bunch of concepts per se. It's actually an encounter. And so being Christian is the result of an encounter, a meeting with a person. That person, of course, being Jesus Christ. Now, in a sense, that could actually be the answer to the question. We could actually end our workshop and, you know, this is the time of afternoon where a siesta would feel really good. We want to try and explore that a little bit more, but this is actually, in a sense, the key answer to the question. That the ignition point where young people want to be disciples, where they want to live a life, in other words, that's consistent with the following of Jesus. When young people want to be involved in the church, when they want to give their best efforts and energies in mission, when they want to make a contribution for the world in and through the church, that stuff happens because they've met somebody, because they've encountered the person of Jesus Christ. And I want to stress this as being absolutely critical, because everything else flows from it. Christianity is not the result of an ethical choice, but you've got to make all sorts of ethical decisions as a Christian. And Christianity has a rich, deep intellectual tradition that we celebrate, that I'm incredibly grateful for. It's one of the reasons why I love being a Catholic. But they flow from the encounter with Jesus. Okay? They flow from that. They don't begin before it. They flow from it. The second quote that comes from, as I said, Principles of Catholic Theology by Joseph Ratzinger in 1971, off the top of my head, says this. Metanoia, which is the Greek word that we usually translate as conversion, sometimes as repentance, is not just any Christian attitude, but the fundamental Christian act per se. To be a Christian, one must change not just in some particular area, but without reservation, even to the innermost depths of one's being. So, same man, 30-something years apart, saying two slightly different things, but two things that I want to suggest to you are deeply interconnected. That the encounter with Jesus necessarily involves a conversion. It's right there at the very beginning of the gospel. When the story of Jesus begins in Mark's gospel, the first words that Jesus says in the gospel are repent, which is that Greek word, metanoia, and believe the good news. Okay, and variations are of that are also in the other synoptic gospels. So the very heart of the encounter with Jesus is this concept of conversion. And what Ratzinger, prior to him being elected as Pope, says here is it's not just any Christian attitude. Conversion isn't one thing among other things. Conversion is the fundamental act of being a Christian. It's a huge statement, isn't it? What he's saying there is to meet Jesus involves changing your life. And he's saying it's not just changing some bits in some particular area, but without reservation, right down to the depths of your being. Perhaps the great biblical symbol of this, I think, I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about St. Paul, but the other great biblical symbol of this is the disciples on the road to Emmaus. The moment they meet the risen Jesus, remember the story, they meet the risen Jesus on the road, they don't know it's him, they don't realise he's come in disguise, as Bishop Brady was saying this morning. The moment they realise it's him, which of course is a Eucharistic moment when the bread is broken, they all of a sudden do a U-turn. They've been heading out of Jerusalem, they're running away. The moment they realise that the risen Jesus is with them, they turn around and head straight back to Jerusalem. There's a change that happens that is complete and total. So what we're talking about then are two deeply related concepts. The first one is an encounter with Jesus, being the key ignition point of faith. And the second part of that is that that necessarily involves a conversion for us. It involves a change inside of us. And that change is complete, total, and we're going to unpack a little bit more about what that means and looks like. So, here's the next question that flows from that. If encounter and conversion are the ignition point of faith with anybody, not just young people, but obviously with young people, then the two questions that flow from that is how do we help young people encounter Jesus, and then how do we also help them experience a conversion? And the first answer to that is that there's not a silver bullet, right? Okay, there's not an easy answer to that question. But what we're going to try and do now is sort of depth that a little bit further. Is it making sense so far? Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about what conversion is, because perhaps it's open to misunderstanding. This comes from Redemptoris Missio, which is, Redemptoris Missio was John Paul II's document, the mission of the Redeemer, which is all about evangelization. It's really the charter document for what's become known as the new evangelization. And so in a few months, in fact next month in Rome, there'll be a synod on the new evangelization. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the resulting document will have lots of quotes from this one, from Redemptoris Missio. In this document, in number 46, John Paul II provides not a one word or a one sentence definition of conversion, but a number of interrelated concepts where he's trying to tease out what conversion looks like. And it's worth us thinking about that together this afternoon. A complete and sincere adherence to Christ and his gospel through faith. Complete and sincere. One of the things I think that often happens in youth ministry, at least, and perhaps in, and not just, not with, not necessarily just by youth ministers, but by anybody working with young people, and I think also it happens in RCIA programs, is we think what we've got before us is a human being, good person, and what we're needing to do is we want to communicate faith to them. And that faith is somehow or other kind of like the oil, like pouring oil on water, that it adds something to them, but it only adds something to them about, you know, do I believe in God or don't I believe in God? Do I go to church on Sunday or don't I? Do I avoid some behaviours and do others? But that's not what conversion is according to the gospel and according to the teaching of the church. Complete, total adherence. It's not oil on water. It's actually something that penetrates the whole of a human being's life. Okay? The question we want to perhaps be asking ourselves at this point is, it must be some encounter, right? In order to bring about such a change, it must be some kind of encounter. John Paul goes on and says, it's fundamentally a gift of God, a work of the Blessed Trinity. So what he's saying there is that it's a grace. That conversion isn't something that we can manipulate or make happen in and of ourselves. I think as youth ministers, all we can do is to help provide a context for that conversion to happen. But if conversion is fundamentally God's gift, a work of the Trinity, then it's something that all we can do as ministers is say, let's try and provide the best context we can, the best situation for that conversion to occur. But we can't make it happen. That's God's work, particularly the work of his Spirit. John Paul goes on again. From the outset, listen again to the radical language, the total language, the complete language. From the outset, it's expressed in a faith which is total and radical. Strong language, isn't it? Now, we're not saying here that there's not room for doubts. We're not saying there's not room for struggle in the journey of faith. Of course there is. But there's something about this encounter that I think John Paul's trying to get at here that says, I know I've got to live differently as a consequence of this meeting. I think one of the best analogies for this is marriage. You meet it, when somebody meets somebody that, and at first, you know, perhaps they don't know straight away. Sometimes people do. They know the person. The first time they see them, they think, you're the person for me. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Okay? For a lot of people, that's not the way it kind of works, right? It takes a little bit of time. But then there comes a point, perhaps where they, in a sense, really meet that person. Maybe it's the fact that they've, maybe it's the first date. Maybe it's a moment where they've spent a long time talking, where they just think, okay, you are the person I want to be with. And they start reordering their life around that decision. And ultimately that comes to marriage, and ultimately comes to a life that is lived together, where every other decision from that point on is about us, right? That's not a bad analogy for what's going on here. That when I've encountered the person of Jesus, and you know, part of what we're going to talk about in a moment is we're not necessarily talking about something dramatic, but there will come a point, and there needs to come a point where I say, I really know him now, and I know him in a very particular way. And that is that I really believe he's the Son of God, the Lord, that I really believe he's saved me. And therefore I'm going to reorder my life around my encounter with him. That's the kind of thing I think that's going on here. It's not to say it won't take some time. When John Paul says, a faith which is total and radical, in the next breath he says, it's a dynamic and lifelong process. So one of the things that we know about our journey, a journey with walking with young people, I know it from my own experience, and it doesn't stop once you pass 35, the end of the World Youth Day age bracket, is that in the life of conversion, in the experience of conversion, we have times where we're saying, I'm really feel like I'm drawing closer to the Lord, and in other times where if I'm really being honest, I know that I'm not being as faithful. I'm not, you know, my life is becoming ordered around something else as well. So that's part of the dynamism of it. This is something that's very organic in a sense, okay? It's not a straight linear process. John Paul will acknowledge that even as he calls for something, he says that conversion really is about all of me. That's really what he's getting at here. He also then goes on to say it's about turning away from life according to the flesh to life according to the Spirit. So this has that sense of the whole U-turn kind of thing. And he's drawing upon biblical language there. That's why life according to the flesh and life according to the Spirit is in inverted quotation marks. So the reason for that is he's drawing upon biblical language. Okay? And what he's wanting to say here is it's a recognition that my life has been going in this particular direction, and now I want it to go in this particular direction, and there is a moral component to that. In the liturgy, there's a beautiful part of the liturgy which says that we might live no longer for ourselves but for him, right? So we're talking here about a movement in some way or another from a selfishness, a self-focus, to a life given for others in imitation of Jesus. So that's part of this dynamic of conversion. As I said, John Paul's not giving us any one definition. He's trying to bring a whole bunch of things together to give us a synthetic kind of picture of what this conversion looks like. The last point in Redemptoris Missio 46 says, it means accepting by a personal decision the saving sovereignty of Christ and becoming his disciple. I was really tempted to actually put that on another slide and ask you who said it and wonder whether you get sort of, you know, well, it's what's his name, Houston from Hillsong, or Peter Jensen or something like that, but it's the Pope, right? Using language that to us could sound very evangelical, perhaps Pentecostal, okay? Accepting by a personal decision the saving sovereignty of Christ, that's another way of saying recognizing his lordship in my life and becoming his disciple. And we hear there, of course, the tones of anointed and sent. So here we're talking about something that we're saying that part of conversion is something that I very personally have to do. that this encounter has to be a personal encounter. Make no mistake about it, cultural Catholicism in this country is dead. Nobody is a Catholic anymore simply because of what their parents did. Okay? In fact, that was never ever true. You can't actually inherit faith from your parents. Okay? Your parents are the most significant influence. All the research backs this up. Your parents are the most significant influence upon your faith. But unless your faith becomes yours by a personal decision, which is the result of an encounter with Christ and a desire to live a life as his disciple, which means a conversion, unless all that happens, right, you're not a disciple, okay? There's an old saying that says God has no grandchildren, okay? So this is really critical. A personal decision is required. I've got to say, I believe that. I believe that I've met Jesus. I believe I've encountered him. I want to follow him. And I've made that choice. That decision is mine. From that, everything else will flow. The rich, big vision of what it means to be a Catholic. Church's social teaching, the church's moral teaching, the spiritual tradition of the church, the intellectual tradition of the church. All of that comes into play, and we need to form people in that. And we'll talk a little bit about that at the very end of the session. But it begins, the ignition point, is around this encounter and a conversion that has something of these contours about it. All right? So let me say a little bit about, a little bit more about conversion. I want to just talk a little bit more about it and say that one of the great theologians of the 20th century, a guy called Bernard Lonergan, who's a Jesuit, don't hold that against him. Sorry to all the Jesuits. He sort of describes conversion as there are three dimensions to it, okay? So he talks about religious conversion, intellectual conversion, and then he talked about moral conversion. And some other people who've commented on Lonergan's thought have broken up that moral one into two dimensions. That there's a personal moral dimension where I take responsibility for my life and my decisions and I want to choose the good. But that's a personal kind of thing. But there's also a socio-cultural or even a socio-political dimension, which is where I start saying this is really about the church's social conscience. And as a person experiencing conversion, I realise that I need to be contributing to the advancement of people, the eradication of poverty, the work for justice and so forth. So let me just say a couple of things. We could spend the whole workshop on what Lonergan has to say here. Lonergan says that religious conversion is fundamentally falling in love with God. Really beautiful. Really simple. It's nice. The rest of Bernard Lonergan is really hard to read, except when he says that, right? So it's falling in love with God. Religious conversion is falling in love with God. And what flows from that are the other dimensions, okay? That there's an intellectual dimension to that, which is where I start to really seek the truth, where I really am pursuing the truth. And the moral dimension is where I'm really desiring to choose the good. And so, again, what we're getting at here is that the dimensions of conversion become something that encompasses the whole of the human person. That, if you like, the religious conversion is about my falling in love, but that's about my desire. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. There's an intellectual dimension. As I become convinced of the truth and the need to seek the truth and to be formed intellectually. And there's also something about action and the choices that I make and how I spend my time. That's all the moral dimension of conversion. Got to bring all of those together. And often when people are talking about conversion, they can focus a little bit too much perhaps on one to the exclusion of another. All three are required. They don't also all happen at the same time. Let me give you an example. When I was a 16-year-old and first went on a youth weekend, and I had a profound experience of the love of God, okay, I experienced a religious conversion, okay, in some way. I came home and then the next day I did something, I can't even remember what it was, but it was something pretty selfish and obnoxious to my sister, right? Okay, now I'm still capable of doing things like that, hopefully not to my sister. My point being that I'd had an experience of religious conversion, which was calling me. I knew that that meant I had to change in the way that I was going to be relating to people in some way. All of a sudden it was like, this is about loving people. I get it now in a way I never got before, right? But the moral dimension of that conversion, okay, that loving my sister was a really important part of being a follower of Christ, hadn't quite dropped down to the degree that it needed to, right? Okay. So, and I remember my sister, her comeback was, you call yourself a Christian, you've been on this camp because I've been raving about it, right? And she just went, smacked me and said, no, come on, it's not real. It was real. I had a really profound experience of God, but the full implications of that conversion still needed to be worked out. And that, of course, is why conversion is a lifelong process, right? Okay. Sad to say, I probably still have the potential to be obnoxious. Hopefully not to my sister, but possibly. Okay. Is that making sense? Okay. We're getting a fairly rich kind of picture of conversion as the church wants to talk about it. Okay. This is Caravaggio's calling of St. Paul, or his conversion. Famous painting depicting probably the most famous conversion of all time. Does anybody know what's wrong with the picture? The bishop does. The horse. Yeah, there's no horse in the biblical account, is it? There's no description at all of Paul falling off his horse. We just kind of presumed that, you know, something dramatic had to have happened like that, right? He did go blind, okay? Like that was, you know, remember he has to have his sight restored. My point here is, in the way that we've been talking about conversion, and particularly the way some of our Protestant brothers and sisters might talk about conversion, there could be a perception that it's got to be this really dramatic moment, okay? Does it need to be? Not necessarily. Not necessarily. I speak about a particular moment in my life, and I really mean it. There was a moment where I made that personal decision that I wanted to be a disciple of Jesus because I had met him and encountered him through the gift of his Spirit. But the truth of the matter, of course, is that there were a whole bunch of things that had led up to that moment, and there were a bunch of other really important decisions that had to flow from it as well for me to really be a disciple. So when I talk about a moment, and that was a fairly noticeable, defining kind of moment, I can name it, right? There's truth in that. And there was some level of, there's something of the dramatic about it in the sense that I went from thinking Mass is a fairly insignificant part of my life to this being the most important thing I can do, where I started, you know, I remember, tell you an embarrassing story, I decided I really wanted to stand up for Jesus in my school. And so I wore a T-shirt. I found a T-shirt which was like a surf shirt, like an Oakley shirt or a Billabong shirt or something, but had the fish. How cool is that, right? Yeah? It was so 1990, right? But anyway. And I remember sort of, you know, walking around and one of the guys said, that's a really cool T-shirt. And I said, that's a Christian shirt. Yeah. So there was something dramatic, something really dramatic had changed for me, okay? But the truth of the matter is that there was a whole bunch of steps before it, a whole bunch of steps afterwards. And they matter as well, right? For other people, it might not be such a dramatic kind of moment, and that's totally fine. The point here, though, is that sometimes when people hear that, that means they then filter out, okay, well, the personal decision that I want to follow the Lord doesn't have to happen. That's not true. It might not be dramatic because you've basically been a pretty good person. Faith's always been important to you. And at various moments, it's just grown gradually and incrementally. But if we're talking about conversion in the way that it's described here in the teaching of the church, there ought to be a moment where you say, you know what, it stopped being my parents' faith that I went along with and it became mine. That's one way of putting it. Or there was a moment where I realized that I did believe in Jesus and I did believe that he was risen from the dead and the Son of God, but there came a moment where that hit me and that really touched me, that moved me in a way that it hadn't moved me before. So don't, when you hear conversion doesn't need to be dramatic, don't hear that you shouldn't have to have made a personal decision, because you have to have. It's really that simple. Okay. All right, I'm talking too much and we need to move on. So how is someone converted then? And that's a pretty funky slide. I didn't make the slide. Okay, I just found it I Googled and I found it. But it's a cool slide. The question that I wanted to ask here is it about your head or is it about your heart? Okay? And you guys, being good Catholics, are all going to say both. I knew you were going to say both. Well done. You're totally right. I'm going to suggest to you that obviously we need both, right? Conversion has to be both. There's no question. But I'm going to say I do think it begins with the heart, but the heart understood in a particular way. And so when we're talking here, I want to make it really clear, not either or. Primacy of the heart must be followed up by the intellectual dimension, okay? And as I said, I'm only 90% convinced of it. So the reason why I think this is because I don't know that, like I'd like to believe that, there are quite a number of young people who would say that in some way or another, in a small part, I've had a small part in their coming to a deeper faith, right? Now, fundamentally, that's a work of the Spirit of God. No one should be taking the credit, okay? But if you ask them, they'd say, well, at a certain point, Chris Ryan did this, said this, or something, okay? None of them, I would love to tell you that all of them are the result of my fantastic preaching ability, right? But you know what? That's almost never, ever true. It's the fact that actually I spent time with them as a young person. I loved them, okay? And it came a point where maybe I said something that stayed with them, maybe I didn't. But at some point there, the penny dropped for them and they went, oh, what Chris is on about is Jesus. and I believe I want to follow him, right? Okay, and at that point they go, yeah, it was a little bit about you, but it was really about Jesus. And I say, well, that's exactly the way it should be, right? But none of them were convinced because I came up with a whole bunch of amazing arguments. I don't really think we think our way into Christianity. And that's actually because I think as human beings, that's not the way we're wired about anything. I think of in terms of things that we really love. And remember, Christianity is a love affair. If it's an encounter with a person, if the best analogy for it is a relationship, particularly the marriage relationship, then you don't think your way into being with your spouse. You fall in love with them. Something happens at a deeper level, at a gut level, a heart level. We've used different words at the level of our soul. We've used different words to describe it throughout the last 2,000 years and beyond, really, into the older biblical story. The key thing here is that something happens in such a way that my will is moved. I desire something. People fall in love, and if you ask them why they fall in love with their spouse, they don't go because they're really intelligent and because they're really, you know, wise. They go, you know what, I find it really hard to articulate, but I just thought this is the person I need to be with, right? There's something else going on there, okay? So I want to try and unpack a little bit more about what that means. The great picture of the great statue of Christ the Redeemer stands over Rio. Okay? The idea here is not that we would just show people pretty pictures of Jesus and think that that's somehow going to convince them. Okay? What that picture, what that statue wanted to stand for you as, that if my imagination is grasped, so my imagination is my capacity to make an image of something, to see something. If my imagination has been taken hold of in such a way, it will engage my heart. It will actually, that the imagination is the doorway into the heart. That if you want to be captivated by something, then what you need, if someone is going to be captivated by something, it's because they've seen something beautiful in what they're looking at. Take a great work of art. Somebody who has really come to appreciate that piece of art has seen something there that they found incredibly beautiful. And again, it's not about putting up an image of Jesus and saying, oh, if you just look at a pretty enough picture, you'll fall in love with him. What we're talking about here is that we talk about Jesus in such a way that the compelling attractiveness of his figure comes out. Look at the way Jesus in the Gospels again and again affects people whenever he meets them. What an incredibly compelling figure he must have been. Look at the difference he made in a figure like St. Paul, in every one of the apostles. Look at the way throughout the church's history when people have said, I saw something, I found that he was real. And I decided that this was the person that I wanted to give my allegiance to. This is the God that I wanted to follow. What we're talking about here is that they actually are presented with, and the biblical word for this is a vision of the kingdom, where what human beings aspire to, beauty, meaning, truth, goodness, happiness, the things that are built into us that we say this is what we want in life, we're saying that what we've got to do is offer such a compelling picture of Jesus where they say that's the one who's going to provide that. That's the person who shows me the path to beauty, to truth, to love, to goodness in my life. So it's about proclaiming a compelling account of Jesus of Nazareth, which means being faithful to the Gospels. Read the Gospels closely and you watch people all over the place going, there's been nobody like this guy. And that will culminate on the cross, and I'm jumping ahead of myself, and I'm going to shut up about that for now. But the point being that you need, what we're trying to do here is to say that the way in which people's hearts are changed, which is when they start saying, I'm going to spend my life doing this, is when their imaginations have been caught. Okay? So, yeah, there's a beautiful Pedro Ruppe, one of the great Jesuit generals just after Vatican II. He has a beautiful passage where he says, fall in love with God and it'll decide everything. It'll work out what you do in the morning. It'll get you out of bed in the morning, what makes you cry, what makes you joyful, what you spend your time invested in. Fall in love with God and it'll work out everything else. That's what we're talking about here. And you know that you can fall in love with God and that will decide things, but we can also fall in love with other things and that will also decide some things for us. I want to suggest to you that we're always being converted. The question is not if we're being converted or not. We're always being converted. The question is, to what are we being converted? Okay? St. Augustine would put it like this. Not quite, I'm going to paraphrase him a little. He would say that your love pump, your desires, what you really want, is always working. You can't turn it off. To be human is to have desires, to want something. Okay? Remember his famous saying? Okay? Our hearts are restless till they rest in you. What we do is we start our desires going all sorts of different directions, looking for God. And they come to their rest, they come to the place where they're supposed to stop when we find God. But Augustine says you can't turn the love pump off. Okay? So this is why you can, and Augustine will say in his own life, I got caught up in the things that you had made, the beautiful things that you had created, God. They became my focus, my desire, or the object of my desire. But really what I was looking for when that happened was you. So you're always being converted. It's just a question of to what you're being converted. And the advertising industry understands this, okay? What I want you to do is I want you to watch this ad, and I want you to try and get inside how they're trying to sell you something, okay? That's the question I want you to think about. How are they trying to sell you something? So how are they trying to do it? It's the lifestyle, right? We might say it's a particular kind of kingdom, right? Because they're not saying to you, this car is a really good car because it's got a great engine, because it's got a really nice. They're saying, this is the life you could have if you have this car, right? And they're using sex to sell it for sure. I mean, there's all sorts of sexual sort of, and that's part of the power of it. It's not as blatant as the girl draped out across the car, right? What it's actually doing is, you can have the girl if you've got the car. This is the life that you can have, right? Powerful. Powerful. Now, back to Andrew's point, this is not working on your head. They're not trying to convince you to buy it because it's a superior product, that a Mercedes is better than a Beamer or anything like that. They're saying, no, you can, without actually being as explicit as I'm being now, they're saying, you can have this life. What you need, of course, the first step is the thing that you can do something about. You buy a really expensive car, right? Okay? The advertising industry gets this. They get that the way to mold our decisions, our choices, our will, is through our imagination. So they just gave you a picture of a life you could have. Okay? What we often do in the church, I think, is we think the way that we're going to convince people, young people especially, to believe is we're going to tell them more stuff. And we're surprised when it doesn't work, right? We think, why didn't that convince anybody when I talked about this is what the church's doctrinal teaching is on this particular topic? Well, because it was competing with that and every other ad and every other image of what the good life looks like in our consumer secular culture. We wonder why it's not being particularly effective, right? But if, and this is flagging what I'm about to come to and coming back to what Bishop Peter was saying, but if they saw a group of people who in their lives incarnated a different kind of kingdom, who in their lives were clearly living for something else, and every time you asked them about that, they said, well, it's actually because of my faith. Not in a really pushy kind of way, but in a way that they said, well, the reason why I live like this, the reason for the joy that I've got, is actually because I'm this kind of person. Well, maybe that might start getting us somewhere, right? Okay. What I want to do, just to kind of go a little further into that, and the idea here that I want to try and pick up now is that there are different visions of a good life, of a kingdom, of what it means to flourish as human beings. Okay? I want to try and depth that a little bit, and to do that I'm going to draw upon an old Canadian philosopher, which is about as far away from youth ministry as you can get, right? So Charles Taylor, who's not the dictator of Liberia currently undergoing war criminal proceedings, but rather a Catholic and a philosopher, he wrote a very important book called A Secular Age. Okay? So the concept I want to draw upon from Taylor is the concept of a social imaginary. Now, I want you to keep in mind what we've just been talking about. What's a social imaginary? Well, Taylor talks about it being, firstly, a way of being in the world. What he's trying to get at here is it's not simply the way I see things, okay? It's actually about some more inarticulate things than that. It's about how I understand relationships with other people. It's at what point, you know, for example, is somebody impinging upon my personal life? At what point is my life public? So you can hear how it's deeply cultural already, that it's going to be different in different places to some extent. He's wanting to try and get at that it'll include my most fundamental beliefs, and that they will be so obvious and apparent to me that I can't imagine that anybody would think differently. Okay? An example would be democracy, right? For you and I, democracy is such a given principle, okay, that we don't really, think about the young people you minister to or teach, there is no way that they will question the value of democracy. It is a given. Okay? And they would operate under some principles around that that would be completely unquestioned. Now, I'm not advocating against democracy for a second, but I'm saying that it's a given. Okay? It's presumed. It's more, Taylor would suggest too, we've talked about it being more explicit than implicit, it's also a sort of tacit, affective understanding of the world. So he's trying to say here, it's not something that you can just simply kind of name and define, but it'll be the way in which I imagine things, the way the world appears to me as being obvious and clear and apparent. It's more likely to be something at the core of our identity than something that I can rationally sort of define in a whole bunch of principles. And here's the key. It's not expressed so much theoretically, but more in the images and the stories and the practices. So another great philosopher, Alasdair MacIntyre, will say, if you want to tell me how I should act, tell me what story I'm a part of. Okay? So the social imaginary is about these stories that define who we are. For the Americans, it's possibly a little bit more obvious for us in terms of their culture. For the Americans, the story of the founding of their nation tells them a great deal about who they are, doesn't it, Michael? Land of the free, home of the brave, right? Okay, the whole ideas of that we're founded on this idea of justice for all. These are things that, and it's a story that's told to people, to Americans, that helps shape the way they see things, the way they experience themselves in the world. Right, now this is a tricky concept, okay, to get our kind of head around. Let me try and ground it a little bit in some practical stuff. Let's look at Gen Y / Gen Z social imaginary, okay? Let's look at them. And let's try and define it a little bit. Bishop Anthony today spoke about Christian Smith's book, Soul Searching, which is on the spiritual lives of American teenagers, and particularly about moralistic therapeutic deism. And my impression, listening to people around the room this morning, was that people were going, yeah, we've seen moralistic therapeutic deism. It's alive and well in Australia, right? My gut says that we're not even particularly deist. I think we're a little bit less religious than the Americans are, right? But bearing in mind, I mean, the equivalent study in Australia, the Spirit of Generation Y by a group of researchers based at ACU, based, you know, 50% of young people roughly still say they believe in God in Australia too. So maybe the deism thing's, you know, right. And you'll hear some of, I've amalgamated some of the key principles of moralistic therapeutic deism with some of the Australian findings and with some of the English findings to come up with this summary, okay? For Gen Y and Gen Z, the goal of life is to be happy, okay? The key thing there is we decide what makes us happy, and what I decide and what you decide, knock yourself out. If that's what makes you happy, great, go for it. If this is what's going to make me happy, right? And freedom is, in a sense, the only absolute. The ACU researchers say, you know, we can't even really talk about individualism with Gen Y and Gen Z anymore. All we can talk about here, really, with them is they are so used to seeing themselves as an individual that they simply can't see it any other way. And let me tell you about one of the most, for me, one of the saddest findings or results of that is that if a young person experiences difficulties, problems in their life, and we've heard about some of the pressures on young people's lives, two consequences of that, first of all, is they think they've got to solve it themselves in the first instance. It's only after they can't do that that they'll go to friends, to family. That's interesting, isn't it? Okay? What an incredible pressure. And what I want to really suggest here about why that's a factor of the imaginary is that that would have been, two generations ago, unheard of. You simply wouldn't have thought like that. I didn't think like that growing up. And an older generation, which was even less influenced by this, that had a stronger sense of a communal identity, wouldn't have crossed their minds that if you had a problem, you didn't talk about it to the people in your world, okay? That was how you worked it out. So, and then the second consequence of it too is that because part of that mantra of you decide what makes you happy is if you go after something and you don't get it or it doesn't make you happy, that's your fault. You picked the wrong thing for you. You made the wrong decision. What an incredible burden to put upon a young person. But that's actually the mentality that exists inside young people today. So there's big and significant consequences for that. How do we achieve this, or how do Gen Y and Gen Z achieve this? Key thing from all the research is if I spend time with friends and family, if I have new experiences, if I have fun, they're the key things that are going to make me happy. God, I don't think, you know, there's a really hardcore edge of secularism in Australia, and there's a hardcore secular edge of young people who are really intentionally atheistic, right? The majority of young people aren't like that in Australia. The majority of young people in Australia, God is simply unimportant or just not present. Not in my worldview, okay? Not in my social imaginary. So a hardcore atheist, God actually is in their social imaginary, even if it's the one that I'm constantly rejecting, right? That's not what we're saying here. God doesn't even show up. Possessions aren't that important to this generation or these two generations. They're not that important, but they do help to achieve the fun that I want to have. So they're a means to an end. If you believe in yourself, you can do anything, which I think is one of the most hurtful things we could possibly say to a young person. Terribly, terribly cruel. And when unhappy, I draw upon others' help, but I ultimately do have to solve it myself, as I was saying before. I want to suggest to you, that's my drawing it out, and in the very act of defining it like this, it stopped becoming an imaginary because I'm trying to put it into something that we can grab hold of, right? What this is saying is that this is all implicit in young people's lives. They presume this. They've never really questioned it, okay? So then the second thing then is if we try to say what's a Catholic social imaginary, we're going to see a little bit of a difference. In fact, we're going to see quite dramatic differences. The goal of life, as far as we're concerned as Catholics, is God, communion. That will make you happy. All right. One of the things that we lose sight of so much, I think, often, is that we believe as Christians that God wants us to be happy. That's actually a really important part of the whole gospel message. It's part of Jesus' vision of the kingdom, but there's some things about it that's not exclusive of suffering, for example. That happiness and suffering don't have to be mutually exclusive. Happiness is to be found when my life's ordered to God. In other words, when my love pump, as it were, is directed to God, all my other desires find their appropriate places and spots in my life. Our Catholic social imaginary is fundamentally communal. Okay? We come to God together. It's the great Catholic instinct of it's us and God. And that doesn't exclude the fact that we've got to each make a personal decision, harking back to what I was saying about conversion, but it's never private, personal never means private. The fundamental Catholic instinct is that we come to God. The world is radically good, though fallen. The world is radically good, even though it's flawed because of the effects of sin. And the world is actually the medium of God's presence. This is what we call a sacramental worldview. This is where I can say that I can see God in all sorts of things, in other people, in the beauty of creation, in all sorts of moments and circumstances in my day that are concentrated in the particular moments that we actually call the sacraments. But the sacraments make sense when I see the whole of God's world as being the instrument of God's communication to us. Okay? I'm going through these quickly. We could talk about these all, right? I'm just going to keep whipping through. Freedom's found in service. So freedom isn't simply the ability for me to decide what I want amongst the whole myriad of options, but freedom is actually found in giving myself to something. Okay? Freedom's found in investing myself, in choosing for the good, for excellence, as Bishop Anthony put this morning. Freedom's found not in just choosing between this or that, but choosing what is good and giving myself to it. And this life is opened up to the human person through the great story of Jesus Christ. The way into, as it were, seeing the world like this or being in the world like this is through what we're going to call the great story of Jesus. The phrase great story is a lovely phrase that comes from Father Robert Barron. All right. I'm spending a lot of time on this because I know it's a little bit of a difficult concept and I want to try and really thrash it out. So what we can see here is some fundamentally different social imaginaries. These aren't the only two, of course. There are others that people live by. Gen Y, Gen Z, God's missing in action, secular kind of worldview. Catholic social imaginary, God's central. In Gen Y, Gen Z, the primacy of the individual. Okay, as I said, that's just presumed. And yet, for the Catholic social imaginary, the personal matters. God loves you, he has chosen you, he's called you by name. And yet at the same time, it's deeply communal. We come to God. God deals with us. He calls a people. He unites us. It's the fundamental action of God in the church. Different visions of happiness. Key one in Gen Y and Gen Z is I pick it. In the Catholic social imaginary, it's found in loving truly or rightly. My desires being ordered to God, all the other desires find their place. Seek first the kingdom of God, everything else will be given to you. The world and the human person are somewhat instrumental in the Gen Y, Gen Z view. I'm not saying that people deliberately go out to use each other, but one of the side effects of a mentality of this is how I come to be happy is that people often do end up getting used. The Catholic social imaginary says that the world is a sacrament, the mediator of God's presence, and particularly that it culminates in Jesus, God-man, and that means that human beings are to be loved, they can't be used. So we're talking about two very different visions here. So if I come back now to the image or the idea of conversion, if my encounter with Christ, which is the way into this, if the heart of what we're doing as Catholics, the heart of youth ministry is that encounter with Jesus, and that's the way into this social imaginary, then one way we can understand conversion is it's an adopting of this and a moving away from that. And part of our conviction here needs to be that this is fundamentally insufficient. Now, this is not saying the culture's bad, the world's bad, the Catholics are good. It's not dividing the world up into white hats and black hats. It's not saying that everything about young people is bad, everything about young people, not at all. Everything that young people are looking for here, happiness, love, connection, all the things that make, they're looking for exactly the right thing. God-given, deeply inscribed in the human being. They're looking for the right thing, but often enough in the wrong spot. And that just happens to be Augustine's definition of sin. To look for the right thing in the wrong spot. So this is not making we're not saying here that young people are terribly depraved or, all that. We're not making that kind of a value judgment. What we're saying here is that this is radically insufficient to give young people what they need, what they most desire. There's got to be some confidence here that we actually have something that really is good news. That this is a deeply rich and an authentic way to be truly human, the authentic way to be truly human. And we've got to have a confidence about that, that that's part of what the dynamic of conversion involves. A recognition that the way I have been living, I was trying to be happy like that, but now I've found something else, someone else, and I want to do that. And I don't think we should be ashamed of that. I don't think we should be ashamed of that. So how do we call young people to conversion in youth ministry? Through the great story of Christ and the practices that make him present. Let's unpack that a little bit. Bishop Peter, here's your slide. Okay? What if a young person met a group of other people, particularly some young, but not necessarily all young by any means, who are actually living a life, just as we were just talking about, where they're saying, I really want to live by the principles of this kingdom. I've met Jesus, I've encountered him, I've experienced the call to conversion to be his disciple, and so there's a quality of life about them as they gather together. They share their lives with one another, they pray together, and there's something intangible about it, but there's a quality of their relationship, there's a quality of their welcome, where a young person goes, there's something here, right? You know, the classic line. Any young person gets up and gives a testimony about their journey of faith. They say, there was something in that group of people that I didn't have and I wanted it, right? Well, that's, what did they want? They wanted the relationship with Jesus that they saw lived out, enfleshed, incarnated through the community that they met, right? This is the power of witness. It's an indispensable part of the proclamation of the gospel, and it will come first, because this is how young people first actually get interested. They actually want to know something about who we are, about why we do the things we do. Ask any young person about their journey of faith. Chances are they won't remember a word of a preaching or a teaching or anything like that, but they'll say, I met X and Y and Z, and they were amazing people, and I wanted to be like them. Right? Power of witness. Okay? But what is that witness? I think sometimes we say that and we just presume we all know what that means. What is that witness? It's a group of people who've met Jesus, who've encountered him, who are living a life of conversion, and who are doing that together. I don't really think there are any solo witnesses. I don't think, in fact, I don't, in the sense that I don't think one person can really witness to the truth of who we are. It's actually something we've got to do together. And that bears thinking about, right? That bears thinking about. Key point. People don't have a conversion in order to belong to the church or to a particular faith community. People start to feel they belong to the community and then they have a conversion. Which is really saying just what I said, but it's unpacking it maybe a little bit more sharply so you really get it. Okay? It's when a young person feels that they belong, that they're part of this group of people, that the conditions are right for them to encounter the one that unites all of this diverse group of people in the first place. Okay? So the next step becomes the actual proclamation of the gospel, where we tell the great story. I'm not going to have time to go through it. Can I just say that I think the key elements, we can't give a young person everything. You start with the Eucharist, you start with the church's social teaching, you start with the seven sacraments, you're moving into a different moment. The place where you've got to start when you're actually talking about what do we tell young people, the moment of ignition, the stuff that we've got to talk about for that encounter to be possible is, we've touched about this, the kingdom, about Jesus being the kingdom incarnate, that he, through his actions and his words, forgiveness of sins, healing, showed liberation and freedom, that his death on the cross and his resurrection make that possible for us to be forgiven, to be able to experience the freedom, the life, the joy, the happiness. Okay? Not instantaneously, it's a journey and all that sort of stuff, but these are the things that we've got to talk about. A response of faith and what it means to really be his disciple. To really kind of ground this, and we can't talk about it more, I'm really sorry I've gone late. For example, the Alpha program, anyone who's seen Alpha will know that that resonates, right? What's Alpha supposed to be? An introduction to Christianity. Read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. He talks about these things. Bishop Tom Wright, the Anglican bishop, English bishop, when he talks about simply Christian, talks about these things. Okay? We don't talk about these things. People actually think they know what Christianity is, but they don't. They think it's about being good, okay? Or they think it's about a philosophical system, but it's profoundly about an encounter. And it's when we talk about these things that we make possible the conditions of that encounter. And the practices that make that up is we've got to, people belong when they share in these experiences with us, the practices that make us Christian, that make us Catholic. Things like, first of all, the liturgy, first and foremost. Other forms of prayer, song, keeping Sabbath, forgiving, peacemaking, service, sharing possessions. These are the things that should be distinctive about the disciples of Jesus, the followers of Christ, right? When young people are drawn into those practices, again, we set up the context, we make possible the environment, as it were, for that encounter, for that conversion. So that tries to graphically say what I was just saying. Lastly, final point, ongoing conversion is what we've been... So there needs to be, for that encounter to grow, for that conversion to deepen, we need a couple of fundamental things, which you'll see. Service is really that moral formation. Prayer, the stuff of the heart, that encounter with the Lord, and intellectual formation. We need to be formed also in the intellectual dimension of our faith. So what we call catechesis in the church needs to address those three dimensions, whole of the human person. Okay? That's indispensable as well, but it's not the ignition point. It flows on from that initial conversion, that initial encounter. This is about maintaining the encounter, sustaining the encounter. It's about that initial conversion becoming a life of discipleship. I think if we get that right, then we get the three goals fall into place, more or less. Okay? Or to put it another way, we don't get anywhere near the three goals of anointed and sent unless we're doing this. And I'm really sorry we haven't had time to talk about it more, but we need to stop there, don't we? Sorry.
That was Father Chris Ryan, MGL, with The Spark of Faith. For more talks, interviews and shows, visit creadio.org.au.